The following was recorded at 4 p.m. Eastern Time.
Terror in Barcelona, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Another vehicle attack in Europe. This time it was in Barcelona in Spain. This eyewitness was standing outside a bakery when it happened.
We ran into the bakery with four or five other people and hunkered down.
And later, statues have become flashpoints in America's struggle against racism and hate. They also know about that in South Africa.
We came to a conclusion that there are people in this country and perhaps in the United States who still look at these statues as a way of affirming their own supremacy.
Plus, remember when President Reagan made this joke?
We begin bombing in 5 minutes.
We remember how that went down in the Soviet Union. The stories today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We begin today with the terrible news from Barcelona. Police say a van was driven at high speed through a pedestrian area of the city. Visitors to the Spanish city know the area well. It's called Las Ramblas. Several people were killed in the attack, according to Spanish authorities, and there is a large number of wounded. ISIS has claimed responsibility, and there are reports of two suspects arrested and another killed by police. But there is still a lot we don't know about the incident. The BBC security correspondent Gordon Carrera is following the story.
The white van mounted the pavement in the middle of the afternoon and struck dozens of people in the busy Las Ramblas tourist area of the city. Amar Anwar was close by when the crash happened.
I started hearing screaming. Everybody started to run, so I started to run in the direction. People were running into shops. Families were screaming. Their kids were taking them out of prams. And we started running, and within seconds, police officers were out.
Emergency services asked for people to avoid the area and closed metro and train stations nearby. Steve Garrett was in a market on Las Ramblas.
We ran into the bakery with four or five other people and ran straight upstairs and hunkered down. Obviously, coming from England, it was reminding me a great deal of what happened in London. We didn't know what was going on, and then a second wave of people came through with lots more kind of screaming and shouting, and that was followed by armed police as they seemed to sweep through the market area. They seemed to be looking for someone. They were going very carefully, very cautiously, stall to stall.
Police say they are treating this as a terrorist attack. Vehicles have been used in a number of recent incidents, lorries in Nice and Berlin and smaller vehicles in the UK in attacks at Finsbury Park, Westminster Bridge and London Bridge. In the latter two incidents, attackers went on to use knives against passers-by.
The BBC's Gordon Carrera. We also reached Darren Lucaides, a reporter based in Barcelona. He's been checking in with local hospitals.
From what I've been told, the majority of the victims have been taken to Hospital del Mar, which is in Barceloneta. It's right by the sea, as the name suggests. I'm told by contacts I have there that only two or three have had minor injuries. The rest of the injuries ranged from severe to, you know, reasonably serious. Contacts I have in another of the major hospitals, Hospital del Clínic, more doctors have been called in to help, or they've gone in to help, and there's been a call to donate blood. So many people have gone to donate blood. My contact is telling me that of those that have been brought there, they've been taken straight to the emergency room, to the OR.
Reporter Darren Lucaides there in Barcelona. We'll be watching this rapidly moving story. You can check for the latest at PRI.org. President Trump remains unapologetic in his defense of monuments to the Confederacy. Today, he called such monuments and statues beautiful. Remember, it was a white nationalist protest against the removal of a statue of Confederate General Robert E. Lee that led to the violence and death of one woman last Saturday in Charlottesville, Virginia. Lee was the man who led the war to preserve slavery in the South, and President Trump has now repeatedly come to the defense of such statues and of the far-right protesters who have used them as rallying points. Here at The World, we've been looking inward a lot this week for obvious reasons, but we thought it would also be useful to look outward for some different points of view on the kinds of events and conflicts swirling here at home. And a good place to start is South Africa, which has also had its share of monuments to racist figures from its violent history. One of them is Cecil Rhodes. He was the British imperialist who, some have argued, was the architect of apartheid. A couple of years ago, black students at the University of Cape Town began a campaign to tear down a statue of Rhodes. That launched a national conversation there about how things have changed since the end of apartheid, or not. Wandile Kasibe is a PhD student who was part of that movement. The Rhodes Must Fall movement at the University of Cape Town had several goals, including having a more diverse faculty, making black students more welcome. But it seems like taking the statue of Cecil Rhodes down was the focus. Why make the removal of a symbol the central goal?
For us, the removal of the statue of Cecil John Rhodes was basically a pressure point into addressing a bigger societal issue. We came to a conclusion that there are people in this country and perhaps in the United States who still look at these statues as a way of affirming their own supremacy. They look at these statues as a way of positioning themselves as people who are the leaders of humankind and modernity. And dealing with the statues, you actually deal with a much more deeper psychological problem that is rooted in society. White people in particular used to marvel at the statue of Cecil John Rhodes to say that he was actually a philanthropist. But we held an understanding that the wealth that he had actually accumulated was accumulated at the expense of our forebears, because he actually killed and lynched people who dared stood in his way as he was basically extending the colonial empire. We cannot therefore pretend as if things are normal when we have such symbols in public spaces.
You know, one argument we hear often in the U.S. when Confederate statues are being removed is that they're a part of history, and if you forget your past, you're condemned to repeat it. I mean, we hear that from white nationalists. We also hear it from others who are certainly not white nationalists. Have you heard a similar argument in South Africa? And what do you say to that?
Well, people have made that argument, but they tend to forget that even that history is actually written on other histories, an erasure of other histories. Perhaps our current government should actually find a way of creating a park for these statues so that they are not actually superimposed on people in public spaces. Because a public space is actually a public space for everyone. It should actually celebrate our unity as opposed to celebrating certain heroes that were actually part and parcel of genocidal activities, so that we are not in a position whereby we build a society that is built on trauma. The proposal that we had put to management, to UCT at the time, was that the statue should actually be sent to, you know, the Rhodes Cottage, a museum in Muizenberg, because there, in that context, it's actually contextualized. That's where Rhodes used to live. That's where he passed away. And therefore, having his statue there makes much more sense.
Wandile, the statue of Cecil Rhodes was removed almost 2 years ago. Have you seen some of the changes you were hoping for?
Well, we have challenges still, but it has actually opened that space, and it has allowed, I think, society to rethink and to reimagine these spaces, because we believe that history actually can be rewritten, history can actually be questioned, and history can actually be taken to task. And we can look into that history in a way of creating better futures.
Wandile Kasibe, a student at the University of Cape Town in South Africa, thank you very much for your thoughts.
Thank you very much.
Cecil Rhodes, Robert E. Lee, memorials to both men who symbolize deeply racist policies have been at the center of deep divisions in their respective countries. But then there's the mother of all such landmarks. Valerie Hamilton has this story about how a town in Austria is dealing with its uncomfortable history.
Braunau am Inn would like to be an ordinary town, like its neighbors in this river valley on Austria's border with Germany. But it's not, thanks to an unwanted native son, Adolf Hitler. Hitler was born here in 1889 and was still in diapers when he left, but that's enough for Braunau to still be known as Hitler's hometown.
If you say you are from Braunau Inn, they connect you with, oh yeah, that's where Hitler came from.
Christian Gunn works for the local newspaper. He says Braunauers are not Nazis, quite the contrary, but being Hitler's birthplace means they're stuck with him.
In that case, we have a bad reputation. You know, it's difficult.
Braunau is about 40 miles north of Salzburg, of Sound of Music fame. It's a pretty medieval town of 13,000, with a Wednesday street market and church bells that ring at noon. The building where Hitler was born is close to the center of town, across from an organic supermarket. Now it's vacant and closed to the public, but in the 1930s, during Hitler's rule, it became a kind of shrine for his cult of personality.
And there are some people say, no, he wasn't born in the house. He was born in this table. In the 1938, it was Braunau, Bethlehem of the Third Reich.
Florian Kotanko heads Braunau's Historical Society. I met him at a cafe next door to what everyone calls the Hitler House. Kotanko lives nearby, and he says dozens of people stop by there every day to take pictures. Not everyone who visits is a neo-Nazi, but he's seen bouquets of flowers left there, and once a burning candle.
There are people who come to Braunau because they feel sympathy for Hitler or his ideas, and I think in one way we have to live with it.
Braunau tries to keep the neo-Nazis away. In front of the building, the town installed a block of stone from the Mauthausen concentration camp with an inscription remembering the millions killed by Hitler. It's placed so you can't photograph the building without photographing the stone, too. Every year, Braunau pushes back against celebrations of Hitler's birthday with anti-racism rallies that drown out the extremists.
Die Heimat ist weit, doch wir sind bereit.
But the Nazis just keep coming. In February, a man showed up here in a Hitler costume and was arrested under Austrian laws that ban Nazi propaganda. Just last week, someone posted a Google review of the Hitler House that ended with the words, quote, Adolf Hitler, we will not forget you. And so last year, Austria's government went one step further and expropriated the privately owned building. The country's interior minister said Braunau's unloved landmark would be razed to the ground, erasing its dark appeal once and for all. But Braunau said no.
Everyone thought it wouldn't do any positive effect. If you destroy this house, should there be an empty space? Everyone will know. Should you build another house, another building? Everyone will say, yeah, this is the place where it was, so it won't help.
As an example, Kotanko tells me about the grave where Hitler's parents were buried. It was removed to try to keep neo-Nazis away, but he says it didn't make a difference. Now extremists just visit the place where it used to be. The point is, he says, history has already happened, and you can't keep people from remembering it. What you can do is make sure that when they do, they know the truth. And therein may lie a lesson for every place saddled with a controversial monument, from the Hitler House to a statue of Robert E. Lee.
I can understand people who think it should be destroyed, yeah. The Americans tore down Saddam Hussein, the famous statue. But his history wasn't ended. Just because out of the eyes, it's not out of the brains of some people. Even the Romans had names of their emperors put out of memorial plaques, but it didn't work. It didn't work. So you have to deal with the past. You have to tell the people what was.
Braunau has realized it can't erase its past. What it can work on is its future. And in the future, Braunau plans to remodel Adolf Hitler's birthplace and turn it into a center for the disabled. For The World, Valerie Hamilton, Braunau am Inn, Austria.
A far-right activist in Charlottesville and a notorious Romanian from the 1930s will connect the dots just ahead here on The World.
I like words.
A podcast.
Crunchy, crackly words.
About language.
Trixie, Tucker, Gentile.
The World in Words.
Oh, heavens, my gracious landsake words.
The World in Words.
Get it on Apple Podcasts.
Or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. In the coverage of the violence in Charlottesville and its aftermath, we were struck by one image in particular. It's of Matthew Heimbach. He was one of the organizers of the Unite the Right rally, and he later showed up in court to support the driver of the car that killed counter-protester Heather Heyer. And when he did, he was wearing a T-shirt with a picture of a guy named Corneliu Codrianu, not exactly a household name in the U.S., so we looked him up. Turns out Codrianu was a notorious Romanian fascist from the 1920s and 30s, a raging anti-Semite, and the group he founded, the Iron Guard, was behind pogroms that killed tens of thousands of Romanian Jews. He's now a hero for the far right, especially in Europe. Dr. Radu Ionid studies the Holocaust in Romania at the United States Holocaust Museum. Tell us who Corneliu Codrianu was, if you would.
Well, first of all, I need to tell you that Codreanu was a murderer. In 1924, he personally shot in the head and killed the prefect of the police of Iași, the second largest city of Romania. Number two, he was a heavily anti-Semitic person, as you already stated, advocating the elimination of the Jews from Romania. He tried to implement a fascist dictatorship in Romania to forge a close relationship with Nazi Germany and fascist Italy. And he tried to destroy, to abolish the Romanian parliamentary democracy. The Legion of Archangel Michael, also known as the Iron Guard, was an extreme nationalistic mass movement with heavy xenophobic mystical features, which organized death squads to kill political and ethnic adversaries.
Did he personally know Adolf Hitler? Were they in communication?
I don't think that they met, but Adolf Hitler liked him very much and, in fact, intervened on his favor with King Carol. Codreanu was assassinated in 1938 by King Carol in prison, but his followers came to power in September 1940. And indeed, they were massively involved in killings of Jews and of Romanians, by the way.
Right. Well, you're kind of tipping to my next question. What was his impact on Romania and on Europe, especially with all these followers, even after he died?
So first of all, as I said, the Iron Guard came to power in September 1940. Although they were in power for a short time, they killed 122 Jews in the pogrom of Bucharest in January 1941. They implemented what Codreanu wanted, a strong close alliance with Nazi Germany, and they started to eliminate the Jews from the economic life, from the cultural life, to discriminate heavily against them. Although they were eliminated from power by their fascist ally, Ion Antonescu, the Iron Guard's legacy lasted. After World War II, Iron Guards in emigration in Western Europe, in the United States, continued to be active.
So I said earlier that Codreanu is a hero for far-right groups today. You agree with that?
Absolutely, especially for people who know something about the history of Romanian fascism.
And how did he become a hero? How did he become popular, not just in Romania, but here in the United States with white nationalists?
First of all, Codreanu, because he was killed in prison, was considered a hero by the fellow Iron Guards. Also, even when he was alive, he cultivated his own image of a supreme leader who cannot be wrong. So he is considered a sort of martyr of the Iron Guard. And this is something that Iron Guard groups in Western Europe and the United States continue to cultivate.
Did you see the picture of this guy in Charlottesville with the T-shirt, the black T-shirt of Cornelio Codreanu?
Yeah, I saw it. Everybody with his own taste.
What did you think, though, when you saw this face of this man who was, well, as you say, a murderer in the 20s and 30s in Romania?
Well, I will tell you something which is more important than what I would say. I received an email from a survivor from the Holocaust of Romania who lives in Florida. And this lady who lived for 10 days with a dead body of her mother near herself, because it was heavy snow and nobody would come to carry the body of her mother, said to me in writing, "You have no idea how this Charlottesville event affected me. As a Holocaust survivor, to see the resurrection of Nazism is almost unbearable. For the first time in 45 years, since I live in the United States, I'm scared to death to the morale of part of this country, of the morale of the part of this country." End of quote.
Yeah, well, I think
so
this is
what I would answer, you know. If people get scared as Holocaust survivors by this, it means that we have a problem.
Radu Ionid, historian at the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington. He studies the Holocaust in Romania. Thank you very much.
I thank you for having me.
Like many of us, our friend Deepak Singh has been thinking a lot about Charlottesville these days, but for him, it's more personal than many because Charlottesville was the first place he lived when he came to the United States from India.
I moved to the beautiful college town in September 2003. Charlottesville was heaven that month. Gorgeous leaves, blue skies, gentle breezes. Long story short, I fell in love with Charlottesville. I lived there for 8 years, and it remains my favorite city. But my heart breaks to see the streets filled with anger and hate just a few days ago. As a new immigrant, I worked in an electronics store in a mall in Charlottesville, and I sold a lot of cell phones. Back then, flip phones were the craze, and there was a big demand for accessories like decorative faceplates, kind of like a personalized case for your smartphone. There were hot pink faceplates, ones that looked like a dollar bill, the American flag, or camouflage. And people would often come in asking if we carried a Confederate flag faceplate. We did not, but I would send customers to an Indian couple in the mall who had a kiosk just for faceplates. I told the couple about the demand for the Confederate flag. They got the message and were quick to drape their kiosk with hundreds of flag faceplates. But I didn't understand the meaning of the Confederate flag or its history. Neither did the Indian couple. I didn't think about it much then, and the couple was happy that I sent customers their way. Though some of the same people who bought their faceplates also told them to go back to India. This week I have been wondering if some of those same people also took part in the rally in Charlottesville.
Writer and former Charlottesville resident Deepak Singh. Later in the show, we're going to hear about another group that appears to have an affinity for Confederate flags, white nationalists in Poland.
Some of them are using symbols that resemble swastikas and neo-Nazi symbols, and some of them also happen to use Confederate flags.
What the far right in Poland shares with the alt-right in America. Stay tuned for that.
What would the news sound like if media were diverse?
Things get racialized here. Muslim is this weird racial thing here, and I don't think our parents were prepared for that.
I'm Rupa Shenoy, host of the podcast Otherhood. Listen to What You're Missing on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Marco Werman. Coming up, I speak with BBC News America anchor Katty Kay about the turmoil in America and our planet's shifting power dynamics.
This would be a very good time to have strong, clear moral leadership from the United States, but we don't have it, and that's a problem.
Why Katty Kay sees a diminished America, that's still ahead, right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. It is a timeless tradition, or it used to be anyway, the back-to-school essay, what I did on my summer vacation. In the case of Katty Kay, anchor for BBC World News America in Washington, she spent her summer in Europe, but it's what she saw when she recently returned to the U.S. It seems to have really put her summer in perspective, and not necessarily in a good way. Katty, welcome back to the States.
Thank you. It's good to be home.
Maybe welcome is not the right word. Your essay is filled with a lot of shock at what you see in this country you watch so closely. What changed in the few weeks you were away?
Well, two things really struck me, and one is internal and one is external. So it's how America feels about itself and how the rest of the world is feeling about America. I spent a few weeks in the UK, in France, and in Spain. And it really struck me when I was traveling in Europe, the degree to which Europe is feeling more confident at the moment, and I would say it's largely continental Europe. Brexit is clearly a big issue for Brits. But in France, they've just elected a new young president. There's a sense of economic revival. He is pushing ahead with reforms. And they are feeling that the center of global gravity, if you like, is shifting to Europe. And there was almost a sense of dismissiveness about the United States. Repeatedly, people said to me, well, nothing can get done in America anyway. And so we're going to have to figure out ways to push ahead on key issues like climate change and trade pacts. And you can see that. You can see the Germans are doing that. Angela Merkel is talking to the Chinese. She's talking to the Indians about critical issues. The Europeans are talking to each other about how they can lead on things like climate change. And when they spoke about America, it was as of a country that had lost its way, that had lost its leadership, that wasn't very valuable, almost with a sense of dismissiveness. And I use that word very carefully, but after 4 weeks in Europe, that was my overriding impression.
And how are Europeans seeing the situation here more broadly? Like, what were the burning questions everyone on the continent wanted you to answer?
Well, look, everyone is still fascinated by Donald Trump. But they're fascinated in him in a way, you know, people kept talking about, you know, Game of Thrones or some reality TV show, almost like what's happening in the White House is some kind of entertainment freak show. I mean, that's really the impression I got, that people are rolling their eyes and thinking, oh my God, there the White House goes again. It's so chaotic. The president doesn't know what he's doing. Nothing can get done in Washington. And then you have, you know, the foul-mouthed language that came out. I went down to breakfast after Scaramucci's comments and had to censor what was in the news from my 84-year-old mother. I mean, that's the kind of...
That was the comments you made to the New Yorker magazine.
Exactly. Yeah. And that, you know, you kind of think, if I'm having to censor the news, I'm used to censoring the news for my kids, but not for my 84-year-old mother. That kind of language I just didn't want her to have to hear over breakfast. And that's, it's that diminishment, a mixture of dismissiveness and, wow, it's really crazy, was the overriding impression that I got amongst Europeans in terms of their view of the States right now.
As someone who lives and breathes the U.S. and done so for 20 years, I mean, it's also your home. How does all this make you feel?
Yeah, and I'm the mother of four children who have dual nationality. They have British passports, but they also have American passports. I think I feel very concerned about this. We are living in a time where global power balances are shifting. We've come out of the kind of post-Cold War honeymoon, and China is flexing its muscles in Asia, and Russia is flexing its muscles in Europe. And this would be a very good time to have strong, clear moral leadership from the United States, but we don't have it. And that's a problem for the U.S. and for the rest of the world. And as somebody who lives here to see the country so riven by divisions and to see those scenes in Charlottesville, of people carrying swastikas in the streets of an American city, that is, it's not just heartbreaking, it's scary and alarming. And as somebody who comes from a continent that has seen those images, not in my lifetime, but certainly in my parents' lifetime, I know how distressing that is. But it's this sense of lack of global leadership, actually, that I find almost more concerning, that America is ceding its place to other countries.
Katty Kay, anchor for BBC World News America in Washington, thanks very much for your thoughts. Really appreciate your time.
You're welcome.
So now we know that President Trump really meant what he said Saturday, that many sides were to blame for the violence in Charlottesville. David Duke, the former head of the KKK, thanked Trump. So outrage and accuracy from those who say Trump is emboldening white supremacists by equating them with counter-protesters instead of condemning them. There's an interesting parallel here with Poland. In 2015, Poland's ultra-conservative white nationalists helped the ruling Law and Justice Party take power. And since then, the Law and Justice Party has taken control of state media, tried to seize power from the judicial system, and have done little to curb the growing influence of the far right. Anna Stefaniak is with the University of Warsaw Center for Research on Prejudice. Can you tell us a little bit about these white nationalist groups in Poland, Anna? Like, what kind of symbols and language are they using? Would they be recognized by some of the marchers in Charlottesville, Virginia, perhaps?
They may be, because some of them are using symbols that resemble swastikas and widely known neo-Nazi symbols. And we now have several groups in Poland that are gaining increasing prominence and are supported more or less openly by the ruling party. And some of them also, not very often, but they happen to use the Confederate flags as well. So wow. The symbols are shared to an extent.
Do you know how many people are in these groups?
I do not know. However, their presence is increasingly visible in the public space. And there are marches and demonstrations organized by the far right, most prominently by the National Radical Camp, which I believe is the largest nationalist organization in Poland at the moment. Even yesterday, there was a demonstration in Warsaw organized by the National Radical Camp. And similarly to Charlottesville, there were protesters trying to stop the march from walking through Warsaw, and the protesters were forcefully removed by the police, which was protecting the nationalists marching.
So, little surprise, just like Donald Trump, the leader of the Law and Justice Party, had a lot of support from white nationalists during the election in 2015. How has that affected the political climate in Poland today?
Well, I think the biggest change is in the rhetoric that is now common in public space in Poland. So things that were not acceptable to be said in public are now acceptable. It shows in the results of another big research at the Center for Research on Prejudice, namely that in 2014 and 2016, a large representative sample studies were run, which asked large groups of Polish youth ages 16 to 18 and large groups of Polish adults about the frequency with which they see hate speech in many media such as written press or the internet or on TV, or how often they come across it in their private lives, for example, talking with their friends. And results show that while in 2014, about half of the people that we asked said that they did come across various forms of hate speech. In 2016, it was between 70, 75, 80%. So we see a huge increase, which shows that the way that Poles now talk and express themselves has become much more hateful than it has been a few years back.
Have there been more white nationalist rallies recently in Poland, and have any become violent?
I don't have the statistics for it, so I cannot say whether there really have been more. It seems like there are more, but what we have been witnessing is an increase in hate crime. So there is data by the Polish police and by the National Public Prosecutor's Office that show that there is a huge increase since, for example, 2014 in hate crime, and primarily directed at Muslims. So this could speak to an increase in right-wing violence, but I don't think there is any data on whether people who perpetrated those crimes were members of the radical organizations.
I got to say, the parallels between Poland and the U.S. right now are really striking. I know you've been studying this for a while, Anna. Did it surprise you how quickly hate speech and symbols have become kind of normalized in Poland?
It is surprising, but also when we look at the migration crisis and how Poland is still a very homogeneous country and Poles don't have that much contact with people who are different than they are in terms of religion, ethnicity, it is also understandable in a way. So the ruling party has played the fear of otherness to a great extent, and the effects of that is what we see right now.
Anna Stefaniak with the University of Warsaw's Center for Research on Prejudice. Thanks very much for sharing this with us today.
Thank you.
Kenya had a presidential election last week. There was a declared winner, incumbent Uhuru Kenyatta, but the country is still on edge. Many were worried that the vote would spark the kind of violence the country saw in 2007 after another presidential election. So far, that has not happened, but some violence has been reported, and the Kenya National Human Rights Commission says it's coming from the police. Reporter Brenna Daldorf spoke with someone who says he witnessed police violence towards protesters and bystanders in Kibera, a slum on the outskirts of Nairobi. But this isn't just any witness. He's Octo Pizzo, one of Kenya's most well-known hip-hop artists.
Last Saturday, Octo Pizzo had some tea with his cousin Olu. When they were done, Olu headed back to Kibera, the slum where they both grew up. Octo Pizzo went home and flicked on the news.
Sarah Kimani filed this report from Kibera.
A day earlier, the Kenyan Electoral Commission had named the incumbent president, Uhuru Kenyatta, winner of a tightly contested election. The opposition candidate, Raila Odinga, says the election was rigged and he's going to court. Back in 2007, a disputed presidential election sparked horrific violence across Kenya. So this year, the government deployed more than 180,000 police ahead of the vote. But worrying things were being reported about the police response to opposition protests. Octo heard from friends in Kibera, which is a stronghold of the opposition, that police shot live rounds on Friday night. Still, Octo says on Saturday, everything seemed quiet again.
So I'm watching TV, then they started shooting again, now crazy.
Octo immediately thought about his cousin, who had just left to go back to Kibera.
And I'm trying to call him and he was not picking. So I started feeling, was this guy shot and his way there, or what's happening?
His cousin wasn't picking up, so Octo decided to just go there, on foot, because he was worried the roads might be blocked. On the road into Kibera, Octo finally met up with Olu. They found themselves near a group of media clustered behind the police. Way on the other side were guys he knew from Kibera, protesting.
As long as they're not robbing anyone, they were just burning tires, which is a global thing when people are, like, demonstrating.
Octo says the police started throwing tear gas.
But once now the police started throwing tear gas, now people started throwing stones at them.
Protesters responded by throwing stones. Pretty soon after that, Octo says he saw police shoot live bullets into the crowd.
And when you say they shot live bullets into the crowd, was anybody injured?
People were shot. They shot a guy here in Obodaboda.
a motorcycle taxi. The man got shot in the leg.
They shot another old man in the shop when he was buying milk. We have photos. If you want to see them, we can show you.
Okta says he tried to talk to police. He thought they might listen to him since he's a well-known musician. No luck.
They just told us, like, hey, get away. You know, the guys are throwing us with stones, so what do you expect?
Okta stuck around until he got tear gassed. He's telling me about this a few days later. We're drinking milky chai in a little restaurant in Kibera. Kibera isn't the only place where this happened. Human rights groups say at least 24 people were killed by police bullets during post-election protests across the country, including an 8-year-old girl who was playing on her balcony. Over the weekend, the acting security minister, Fred Matiang'i, denied that police fired live bullets at bystanders. Okto says he's disturbed that authorities maintain police only shot a few looters. He wishes President Kenyatta would speak out more strongly against the police actions.
When leaders are not speaking about it, people think it's okay and the police think it's okay.
He wishes opposition leaders had spoken out earlier, too. Okto says people in Kibera are scared to go out, so he's working on organizing a food drive. He's been spending a lot of time there in the past few days. Even though he knows the place well, he says people have been worried about him going back.
Even my fiancé telling me, like, why are you going? Like, why do you have to go? I have my aunt telling me, why are you going to this place and it's dangerous now? Because I have to. Who's going to speak? So I should just keep quiet, and then when it cools down, I come up with some hit song and I expect the same guys to dance. These are the guys who made me who I am.
Recently, Okto spent a month in the United States. He says he saw people there struggling with how to speak out and what to say about issues of social justice. For him, speaking out isn't a choice.
You know, if you're here in 2007, or if you've ever been in a violent place, or if you've been affected with violence, or if you know a friend of yours who have died of violence, you can never keep quiet.
For the world, Brenna Deldorf, Nairobi.
Okay, whatever the kids say, when she speak, you listen. We want peace, but we keep fighting. What will leave us in pieces? Jesus.
Okto Pizo there with his song New Africa.
Better we witness, but this is Africa Enterprise. We mean business.
And we've got just a minute here to tell you about something we're working on for tomorrow, an unlikely story from the Cold War.
When I was 17, I got from a friend a record of Frank Zappa, and the name of the record was Burnt Weenie Sandwich.
Burnt Weenie Sandwich. Those words that East German did not understand, but they drew him into a lifelong fascination with an eccentric American rock star who commissioned orchestras to play his music and had a taste for salacious lyrics. Why East Germans still love Frank Zappa, that story tomorrow. It is August, and unscripted comments by an American president have shocked and terrified millions of people. Nope, not Donald Trump's comments this week about the racist violence in Charlottesville. I'm talking about Ronald Reagan in August of 1984. The president made an off-the-cuff joke in front of an open mic, and it ended up triggering a wave of anxiety here and all across what was then the Soviet Union and beyond. My BBC colleague Dina Newman lived in the Soviet Union at the time, and she takes us back now 33 years to refresh our memory.
Testing the microphone before his weekly address to the nation, this is what President Reagan said.
All right, my fellow Americans, I'm pleased to tell you today that I've signed legislation that will outlaw Russia forever. We begin bombing in 5 minutes.
Reagan's words were not part of the weekly address, but they were nevertheless recorded and soon leaked out.
Everybody knew that it was a joke. He didn't intend it to go out. And it was well received with a chuckle.
Morton Blackwell had just moved on from his job as a presidential advisor. He may have thought it was funny, but many Western commentators found it at best in poor taste. And in Moscow, it caused a real storm.
TASS is authorized to declare that the Soviet Union is appalled at the unprecedented hostility of the US president's statement. Such behavior is incompatible with the responsibility of the head of state, particularly one with a nuclear arsenal.
As far as the Kremlin was concerned, Reagan's joke was the latest in the series of threats against the USSR. 2 years earlier, Reagan had promised to send communism to the ash heap of history. Then he called the USSR the evil empire, and Morton Blackwell was thrilled to hear that phrase.
I was special assistant to the president for public liaison, and it was exactly the right thing to do.
For US conservatives like Morton Blackwell, communism was the worst enemy of humanity. So Reagan's promise to crush communism was music to the ears of American conservatives. Even better, the former film star added a light touch to his anti-communist crusade. He loved anti-Soviet jokes, and Morton Blackwell once supplied him with a whole collection.
One that he told in public many times was the story of the American and the Soviet arguing about freedom, and the American said, well, I can go out and stand in front of the White House and yell, down with President Reagan. And the Soviet said, well, that's nothing. I could do the same thing. I could go stand outside the Kremlin and yell, down with President Reagan.
But for most people, the Cold War was not a joking matter. Tension between the USA and the USSR grew during Reagan's first term. The two superpowers traded increasingly bitter accusations.
Ronald Reagan and the United States didn't cause Marxist dictatorship in Nicaragua, or the repression in Poland, or the brutal new offensives in Afghanistan, or the destruction of the Korean airliner, or the re-Stalinization of the Soviet Union.
At the same time, in the USSR, people were frequently reminded that the USA was the only country which had ever used nuclear weapons. Like Morton Blackwell in the USA, Soviet children grew up in fear. But for them, it was the fear of a US nuclear attack. In schools, they were taught survival techniques in case of such a calamity. And the Soviet press used Reagan's nuclear joke to ratchet up the anti-American hysteria.
This is not simply the case of bad taste graveyard humor. This is the naked credo of American imperialism in its most militaristic and irresponsible form. Reagan's dream is to strike Russia with a nuclear missile. For 4 years in a row, Reagan has been signing a gigantic defense budget, fueling the arms race. We are witnessing a premeditated and criminal sabotage of peace-building initiatives, which could have saved the world from a nuclear catastrophe.
It was not only card-carrying communists who were outraged. Living in Moscow at the time, I found Reagan's joke deeply alarming. And I'm still curious, what was on the president's mind?
Ronald Reagan had a great sympathy with people who were being oppressed by communism. And you may not have felt oppressed by communism, but many other people were hauled off on trumped-up charges and put in the Gulag concentration camps. Now, getting rid of that may or may not have been important to you, but I think it was important to a lot of people in Russia, wasn't it?
Absolutely, it was, and it was to me. My family had suffered in gulags. However, sat in Moscow, it did not make me feel safe. It did not seem funny. If you were in Israel or in Washington, perhaps it would have been funny. But I'm just wondering whether you can imagine what it feels like when you are on the other side, as it were, not supporting the other side, but physically on the other side.
Well, I have to ask you, what was the extent of your desire to change the system? Did not you think that sending members of your family off to the Gulag was evil?
It was, but much as I hated the system, I didn't want to be bombed.
Then I think it was primarily a function of your lack of understanding of the American political system. Reagan did not say this in a speech. He said it in a way that was a private joke. It was, I admit, difficult for somebody living in the Soviet Union to have a clear understanding of what was going on in the West. But if you'd had a better understanding, I don't think you would have been so frightened.
But not only did most Soviet people have no idea of what was going on in Washington, they were losing faith in their own leadership. Three Soviet leaders died in as many years, prompting Reagan to joke that he didn't know who was alive to negotiate with in Moscow. But in early 1985, Mikhail Gorbachev came to power. To everyone's relief, he was relatively young, healthy, and willing to reform both the USSR and its relationship with the West. His reforms eventually led to the collapse of communism. But Morton Blackwell believes that that is something Ronald Reagan should get the credit for.
He set into motion a series of circumstances which resulted in the fall of the Soviet Empire. And I'm very proud that I was with him. I'd been persuaded that he was best for our country, and it turns out that he was best for the world.
Ronald Reagan died in 2004. Morton Blackwell is the founder of the Leadership Institute, which he still runs.
The BBC's Dina Newman reporting there.
Bombing in 5 minutes.
Something else you may remember from the time, this song, 5 minutes, Bonzo Goes to Washington, Bootsy Collins, Jerry Harrison and Friends, inspired by Reagan's 1984 joke, not a joke. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
We begin bombing in 5 minutes.
PRI, Public Radio International.